scale, this was dramatic, and to my knowledge, it's the first time we've ever tried to do anything like this with this type of manpower.
A crime sweep in the Bethel region nets numerous arrests. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, increasing the numbers in ethnic diversity for the Anchorage School District.
They're going to be far stronger adults and be much more accepting adults and not have so many stereotypical feelings about different races or cultures or religions.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
The Coast Guard is reporting that the bulk carrier Golden Seas successfully anchored in Broad Bay in Dutch Harbor early this afternoon after the tug Tor Viking towed it more than 500 miles along the Aleutian Islands through seas of more than 20 feet at times. The Golden Seas will remain at anchor in Dutch Harbor while repairs are made. The Coast Guard will monitor repair work to ensure the vessel and its engine are safe for the continued voyage. U.S. Marshals assisting Alaska state troopers conducted a six-day sweep in the Bethel region. The sweep ended yesterday and included 74 arrests in 13 villages. They're calling it the Village Crime and Community-Oriented Policing Program, and it has been so successful that it might be established in other areas of the state. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
To prepare for the expected onslaught of arrests, preparations were made with the superintendent of the regional jail in Bethel.
What he had done a day or two before we started was basically take a load of prisoners at Anchorage to clear space.
Lieutenant David Tracy supervises the trooper detachment in the YK Delta.
The scale of this was dramatic, and to my knowledge, it's the first time we've ever tried to do anything like this with this type of manpower.
34 law enforcement officials were involved in the six-day sweep. Eight pairs of troopers and marshals stayed in village schools overnight. They responded to regular law enforcement calls and contacted all sex offenders to confirm their registration information. They also had time for some preventative work, like presenting at local schools. The idea was to have extra law enforcement staying in the villages instead of flying in to respond to emergencies after they happen. Tracy says they found that having officers on the ground makes all the difference.
A lot of times, individuals aren't going to call us and report to a trooper in Bethel. It just doesn't happen very often, and sometimes when it does, it's hard for us to respond immediately to gain, you know, access to a place, to find evidence, to make a case, to do that. But when you have people on the ground in the villages, you know, folks are more apt to, if they're finally fed up with an individual in the community that's selling alcohol and causing, you know, various problems, they're more apt to report that to us, and then we can immediately go and knock on a door and see what we can find. And that's exactly what happened here.
The six-day sweep brought in U.S. Marshals and troopers from other parts of the state, as well as a few marshals from the lower 48. Eight troopers with the Alaska Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement were also on board. They worked with village law enforcement to coordinate the initiative. All in all, there were 19 warrant arrests, 16 arrests of sex offenders who failed to register, 12 assault arrests, 10 homebrew-related arrests, as well as a number of others. The U.S. Marshals' involvement didn't just start with the six-day sweep. Their presence in the YK Delta goes back to September. The service has been responsible for the Adam Walsh Act, making sure sex offenders are registered throughout the country. And while they were checking on offenders in Western Alaska, they saw a bigger need. The Marshal Service started to send out a few officers at a time into the region to help the Bethel troopers on a regular basis. Mark Oddie, chief deputy with the U.S. Marshals, saw it this way a few months ago.
We know that people in not just Alaska, but rural communities and far-flung communities are constantly having people visit and then make promises and then leave. And we don't want to get into that. Our only promise is presence. We're just going to be out there helping out the troopers, chatting with the kids.
Again, Lieutenant David Tracy with the troopers.
Overall, what we're looking to do was, you know, make the residents of the region feel safer in the villages due to our presence, and let everyone see that we're trying to hold individuals accountable, the folks that are doing things to make it unsafe.
So far, it seems to be working. Hooper Bay resident Nastasha Olrun has seen officers going door-to-door in her village, and it made her happy. Olrun says she used to see intoxicated people regularly in Hooper Bay about 20 to 30 years ago, but in recent times, the presence of law enforcement has made residents a lot more aware of their actions.
I experienced that when I was a little girl, because back then the alcohol was so excessively overused and publicly. And as years go by and then as law got enforced, I never see any intoxicated people walking around out there. And nowadays, it made a big difference.
Olrun is in full support of having the marshals and more law enforcement present in the village.
So it don't have to feel awkward or feel bad when we see some kind of incident related to alcohol.
Tracy says they hope to have similar sweeps once or twice a year and continue to partner with the U.S. Marshals on a smaller scale throughout the year. They are considering expanding the law enforcement initiative to other parts of rural Alaska. The next region on the list is the Northwest Arctic Borough. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The minorities have increased their majority percentage in Anchorage schools. The district's annual ethnicity report shows only 47% of its students describe themselves as white. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
After last night's school board meeting, Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como discussed the 2010-2011 ethnicity report. She noted that the decade-long trend of increasing minority percentages, and which last year passed the 50% level, was continuing.
It shows that our white or Caucasian population went down another percent over the last year, and our ethnically diverse populations are going up.
Asian and Pacific Islander students now represent the largest minority population at 15%, up 1% from last year. The second largest group of students describe themselves as multi-ethnic. That's a relatively new category and is likely drawn from other races, such as Alaska Native, which has dropped from a previously steady 13% to 9% for the last 2 years. Hispanics are 10%, and African American or Black are 6%. Como says, for the most part, the diversity is spread across the district.
I also was amazed when I went through school by school how many of our elementary schools are getting more and more diverse. Almost the entire bowl are ethnically diverse schools, whereas the two extremes, South Anchorage and Eagle River, are not as diverse.
Among the middle schools, Clark has the highest minority at 87%, Mirror Lake the lowest at 26%. East is highest among the secondary schools with 73%, Chugiak the lowest with 24%. Although the report concentrates only on student ethnicity, Como says there is a cost element.
I've got to figure out a better way to present the story because people do criticize us. How come your enrollment is flat, basically, or going down slightly from a few years ago, but your budget just keeps growing? And I say, yes, our numbers are the same, but the differences in the needs of the students have changed radically.
What sort of costs beyond the regular classroom are incurred if a student, say a second grader, does not know English or at least has only minimal skills?
There would be people doing assessments. We would determine that what their language ability, they would either need a full-time ESL-trained teacher to be at least half of the day of that intensive teaching them English, or they might be able to be okay with a tutor, an English language learner tutor. So that would be a less expensive personnel, but it would still be an extra person. Certainly some specialized materials so that they can learn English.
This year, district students list just over 90 different primary languages other than English. But even with the additional cost, Como says the diversity of the Anchorage schools has become one of the district's strengths.
I think if our kids learn to go to school together and get along and learn about each other, they're going to be far stronger adults and be much more accepting adults and not have so many stereotypical feelings about different races or cultures or religions, because they've gone to school with people and they know people as people rather than a stereotype.
Como adds that ability to look beyond stereotypes will serve the students well in the increasing diverse Anchorage and America they will encounter in the 21st century. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a report out says state suicide prevention programs need more funds.
The bottom line is that when people's lives are at stake, we have to value that life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org.
Yesterday, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Alaska's largest, hit its 50th anniversary. But it was also the birthday of the state's smallest refuge, Eisenbeck. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez traveled to Cold Bay for the celebration.
On Monday, the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge turned 50. It's the smallest of Alaska's 16 refuges, covering over 300,000 acres at the southwest tip of the Alaska Peninsula. The refuge houses the 150-square-mile Eisenbeck Lagoon, a wetlands area that serves as a resting stop for millions of migratory birds. Refuge staff and volunteers have spent the past week celebrating the 50th anniversary in Cold Bay, where Eisenbeck's headquarters are located. On Saturday, about 40 people, or roughly half of the town's small population, gathered to look at an exhibit of over 60 photographs of wetlands and wildlife. They also heard about the refuge's history and ecology, and, of course, ate birthday cake. The photos were shown in Anchorage, Juneau, and Homer before being brought to Cold Bay. Nature photographers Mary Frisch and Tom Colopy contributed to the collection, and their work was funded by a Challenge Cost Share grant. Eisenbeck's many acres include everything from volcanoes to quaking bogs. For a couple of summer months, the tundra is covered in colorful lupins and orchids, but during much of the year, snow, rain, and wind roll across the open landscape. Because cloud cover is nearly constant, the land was used as a military site during World War II, and Eisenbeck wildlife biologist Christine Peterson thinks that weather actually gives the refuge a unique sort of beauty.
I hear people constantly say that when it's this gray out, they don't think it's very pretty. I do. I think it's part of its character, and there's so many shades of gray. It's not like it's all gray. There's 150 shades of gray, and that's just as pretty as 150 shades of green. It's just different.
When describing Eisenbeck's history, Peterson often uses the term meeting ground. The area was located near the southern end of the Bering Sea land bridge, and archaeological research indicates that it played an important role in migration. Peterson says that it also served as a zone of contact for a large Aleut population, Pacific Eskimos, and Russian traders. But now, the most common gathering in the area is that of migratory birds. Species like emperor geese, cackling geese, black brant, and tundra swan descend upon Eisenbeck from spring to autumn. That's because of the eelgrass that the Eisenbeck Lagoon contains, says refuge manager Nancy Hoffman.
It's one of the largest eelgrass stands in the world. It's a wetland of international importance, and it's a major stopover for pretty much the entire population of brant. I don't know, it's unique. You really can't find something of this size easily.
Despite Eisenbeck's remote location, the refuge still gets about 5,000 visitors every year, many of them birdwatchers. And the lands themselves also play a major role in the lives of Cold Bay's residents. Here's Joe Carr, who has spent the past 30 years in and out of the town.
As an outdoor person, I probably spend 6 days a week on the refuge. I have a dog. He likes to hunt. I like to hunt. If we're not looking for birds, we're looking for wolves or ptarmigan or we're fishing. Cold Bay, you don't have any other choices. You don't go to the mall. You don't go to the store. You go and you play. And if you're an outdoors person, you go and you play outside. And that's, refuge.
The photography exhibit celebrating Eisenbeck's 50 years is now permanently on display in Cold Bay's airport. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Wrangell High School continues to offer support services following a student's recent suicide. The tragedy is bringing renewed calls for awareness of the issue around Southeast Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
The young woman took her life November 30th, and word quickly spread through the 2,000-person island community. School began the next day with an assembly where students were informed of the incident. Principal Monty Bunis says high schoolers were given a chance to respond and grieve.
We let the kids write on poster boards to the student, and then we had kids write on balloons and walked outside and had a balloon release activity, and then we had kids down in the commons most of the morning, but by lunchtime of that day, we had kids at least report back to their classes. For those kids that needed to have some sort of sense of kind of a normal day.
Counselors and members of the faith community helped students who wanted to talk, and a weekend drama debate meet scheduled for the school was canceled, though wrestlers went ahead with plans to attend a competition in another town.
The school has just tried to work through the individual student issues and just try to keep as much normalcy in the school as we can. Obviously those first couple of days were very difficult, and we're just watching after our kids to make sure that they're doing okay.
The school was somewhat back to normal by Monday. Bunis says Wrangell's response, including counselors from Alaska Island Community Services, churches, and individuals, helped students and staff get there.
When something like this happens, it's absolutely gut-wrenching, not only to the school community, but to the community at large. So there's been an outwelling of support for us from the community. They've been really good about working with our kids and helping our kids.
A student's suicide is not a common event in the region, but it's not as rare as anyone would hope. Wilbur Brown is suicide prevention manager for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
For a tragedy to happen like that down in Wrangell, it definitely doesn't just impact the community of Wrangell, it impacts the community of Southeast. One could go so far as to say this affects the whole state when something like this happens, and which comes back to our belief of one is too many.
One is too many is the name of a regional campaign to raise awareness about suicide and spread the word about programs that can help. Brown says young people and anyone else in crisis need to know others care and are willing to provide assistance.
This is something that, you don't have to keep a secret. Talk to an adult. Talk to somebody you trust. Talk to somebody. Reach out for help. This is a complicated issue for all of us to deal with, and there's really no cut and dry answer to how we can deal with this in our communities except to reach out and talk to other people.
Search offers a toll-free line, 1-877-294-0074, for anyone needing help. The state runs a similar care line at 1-877-266-HELP. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
The rate of suicide in Alaska's rural villages is skyrocketing. Latest figures indicate that the state's suicide rate is more than twice the national average, with a disturbing trend upward during the last part of the decade. Now a new state report pinpoints some underlying causes for the escalating rates. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Bethel Representative Bob Herron called for the legislative report. He says there's just too many suicides in the villages.
It hit home real hard to a lot of my constituents in this region.
Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics data indicates the number of suicides in the state is up from a low of 103 in 2001 to a high of 167 in 2008. Herron says suicide affects an entire village.
Because obviously in a community of 500 or 1,000, generally you would at least know about the person, if not related.
Alaska's suicide rate is double that of the rest of the United States, with Alaska Native rates double or more that of Caucasians. State Department of Epidemiology data indicates Alaska had the highest incidence of suicide in the nation in 2007. Kate Burkhardt, executive director of the Alaska Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, is quoted in the report. Burkhardt says between 2000 and 2009, funding for state suicide prevention efforts totaled more than $7.8 million. That money was awarded to tribal entities, nonprofits, and communities around the state for programs. Burkhart says funding levels remain consistent, but it is how those funds are distributed that has changed. The report indicates in 2003 a merger of state mental health and drug and alcohol divisions into the current Division of Behavioral Health caused a move to a new model of prevention programs and grants based on federal provisions focused on community programs. Community-based prevention requires more community planning and evaluation and intensive reporting, and small entities do not have the staff to manage or to compete for the grants. So in recent years, only regional Native corporations or large organizations and nonprofits have been able to secure grant funding for suicide prevention. Heron says state, federal, and regional health consortiums work well together, but up to a point.
It was clear to me, and it was clear to most everyone, is that for a community to become well and for their residents to become well, it really has to come at the local level. And so should the effort be broader and more intensive in individual communities? That's what I'm hearing, and I hope that somehow with all of us together, we can figure out how we can get it down even farther into the communities.
The Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says one of the strongest preventative measures against suicide in Native culture is youth having the ability to discuss problems with family and friends and feeling connected to community. One such lifeline for troubled Alaskans is CareLine, the 24/7 state suicide prevention hotline. Kimberly Jones, CareLine director, says many callers suffer depression, and about 50% of the calls the service gets are from people assessed at risk of suicide.
We would like to increase our presence in rural Alaska, because oftentimes what we hear from our callers is that they need more resources. Somebody, for example, may be struggling with sobriety and trying real hard to stay sober and might need just to talk to somebody, and we're there for them.
Jones says calls are on the increase. The report indicates CareLine calls are up 55% during the first half of this year compared with last year.
I associate the increase in call volume to increased awareness.
CareLine gets funding from the State Department of Behavioral Health, United Way, and the Tanana Chiefs Conference. TCC pays the phone bill. Jones says state funding keeps them going, almost.
We're basic skeleton crew here. At any given time, we have one staff member available.
Heron says come January, he and other members of the House and Senate are committed to tackling the problem of better funding for suicide prevention.
Is there a delivery system that gets it to the front lines more than it is now? I think so.
Jones, too, says the system of funding needs a new look.
Ideally, I would like to see funding stabilized so that our program in particular didn't have to rely on grant funding that is subject to budget cuts every 3 years.
Statewide Suicide Council Director Burkhart said in the report that there are federal and foundational grants available for suicide prevention programs that are not being utilized. She says the main reason for not accessing the funds is lack of staffing at both state and tribal levels. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future, and by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Governor Sean Parnell has ordered all state flags lowered to half staff to mark Pearl Harbor Day. He says today's lowering of flags is to honor those who fought in World War II. He also says the bombing of Pearl Harbor is a moment in history that will never be forgotten. All U.S. flags at federal, state, and public buildings are also to be lowered. Flags will return to full staff tomorrow. Commercial fishermen expressed shock and dismay at the magnitude of the cuts proposed last week for the halibut catch in southeast Alaska. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports on some of the reaction from the industry.
a pretty crushing blow to the fleet. That's how Petersburg Vessel Owners Association Director Julianne Curry described a potentially huge cut to the commercial halibut catch for 2011 in Southeast. Staff with the International Pacific Halibut Commission recommended a 19% reduction in the total coastwide catch. Southeast Alaska Area 2C is facing a 47% cut. Reacting to the news, Curry pointed out that commercial fishermen have been weathering serious cuts now for a half decade.
You know, the Gulf-wide, the stocks have been down, the quotas have been down, so people really feel like they've been taking responsibility for what's going on with the biomass, and they've been doing their best to accept the cuts, but, I mean, it just seems like what we're doing isn't working. So, you know, to have a 47% cut in 2C, it's going to put people out of business, people who are barely holding on, especially the guys who have bought quota in the past 5 years when we started taking those pretty significant cuts. These are people who aren't making money on their quota. They're not making money off of the halibut they sell because they've lost so much of it.
Many Southeast boats also fish in the Gulf Area 3A, which is facing a 28% reduction. Higher prices for halibut have helped the situation somewhat over the years, but Curry is not sure any increase in value will be enough to overcome a loss as big as this. Fishing groups say that with such major cuts to the quota, there will be fewer jobs for deckhands, and fewer people who bought into the fishery will be able to afford to keep the quota they purchased. Linda Bankin fishes halibut and serves as director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association in Sitka.
That what you see then is people with small amounts of quota left that sell because they can't make it work at this level or they can't make payments, and that drives more consolidation and quota shareholders, and that has a negative impact on the communities, all the industry that depends on the fishing fleet.
Bankin says everyone is worried about conservation of the halibut stocks, and fishermen were braced for another cut this year, but they didn't expect one of this magnitude. The commission has the leeway to go with smaller reductions than its staff recommends, and it's done so in the past. For 2010, the commission settled on a 12% cut to the Southeast quota instead of a 24% cut proposed by staff. In 2009, the commission dropped the quota by 19% instead of the recommended 28%. Bankin thinks those past decisions played some role in the staff's recommendation for the bigger 47% cut this year. In terms of the actual health of the halibut stocks in Southeast, she believes such a dramatic cut to the catch can be misleading.
The actual assessment of the biomass isn't as bleak as that percentage would suggest it is. The assessment of the biomass is we're fairly level. They're not really seeing the recruitment yet in 2C that they see in 2A and 2B. So they're not comfortable saying we've turned the corner, but it's not tubing to see, even though it feels like it is when you get assigned a 47% cut.
The Halibut Commission will make final catch recommendations during its annual meeting in January. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.